The Guardian. Football Weekly.
All aboard for another Football Weekly. On today's agenda, Chelsea closing on title with Gerrard-assisted win at Anfield. John Terry says thanks, TVG, as for once he's not the one in trouble for making a pass at someone he shouldn't. While United clutch at straws, race for fourth place meantime narrows to just two teams, City and Spurs. And Wednesday, they meet at Eastlands. Speaking of big Wednesday matches, in the Championship, there's Owls in Sheffield, in a very real sense, after the big relegation clash at Hillsborough, with Wednesday relegated and plenty of post-game drama. We get more on that. We salute Roy Hodgson's come-from-behind Cottagers as they pull off another one and get the latest from title races across Europe, Spain, Italy, Germany, plus the dramatic final day in Holland with the historic win that's made Steve McClaren first choice for Europe's top clubs. All of that plus posts in today's Football Weekly. And off we go then with today's special bank holiday edition of football's most popular Guardian football podcast, Sean Ingle.
Hello, James.
Hi, Sean. Great to have you with us. Barry Glendening, welcome back.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you, Barry, for asking.
Delighted to hear you.
And Barney Rone, where have you been?
Oh, a bit of this, a bit of that. I haven't been around much. I've been doing a bit of election stuff, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's quite unusual for me to hold forth about things I don't really know anything about in a vaguely sneery way. It's a change of career tack for me. Mm. But I'm back here now.
Well, and what did you discover with this election business?
Well, he discovered that other election journalists take their job very, very seriously indeed.
Really? It's true, there's a feverish atmosphere in there. It's quite exciting.
Is that the big difference between, say, football covering a football match in which everyone's kind of sitting around watching it on telly in the press box and actually being out on the stump?
Yeah, on the stump. You know, football matches happen every week.
Not in a Paul McCartney
sense, we're used to repeating.
Politically speaking.
Well, yeah, it's a pretty big occasion every 4 years, isn't it? I think we get a bit blasé about football.
Are you voting Jimbo?
I am voting. I am voting Jimbo. Yes.
What does Jimbo Party stand for?
What have you got?
What are you offering?
I tell you what, let's have a think, actually. What policies?
Stop football.
Stop football. Make games a bit shorter, because frankly, 90 minutes is a lot of time to give up. Really. I love football.
50-minute games?
50 minutes is fine.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. We could do that.
There are some games that you don't want to finish. There are. And
so we could have a sort of a Roman emperor after 50 minutes. Thumbs up or a thumbs down. As whether the game
a gong, perhaps. You've been gonged off. When would the gong have sounded in Liverpool-Chelsea?
Well, in the first half, I'd have banged the gong after about 10 minutes because it was looking quite dull and there wasn't much being created in the way of chances. And it didn't look as if a goal was going to come at any time soon. And then Steven Gerrard very selflessly stepped into the breach by threading a lovely through ball, defence-splitting through ball to Didier Drogba, who opened the scoring. And then the game kind of improved after that. But it ended as a contest when Frank Lampard scored Chelsea's second.
Mm. His 21st of the season in the league, 26th overall.
He's been quietly excellent, hasn't he? Mm. I thought it was more just depressing than boring, that game. I mean, the sight of Liverpool playing out that last 20 minutes was pretty desperate. And you can't help but feel a bit sorry for that club. I mean, it reminds me of one of those sort of handsome Georgian facades that you see where everything's been ripped out behind it and there's just a couple of poles holding it up and you can't imagine why it doesn't fall over. I mean,
are you calling Gillette and Hicks poles?
I'm not sure they're the people holding it up.
I see.
You'll
right.
be sending them out of the country next, won't you?
Yeah.
I think they're more the kind of pile of rubble. Yeah.
It was very forlorn, the sort of inverted commas lap of honour that Benitez and his players trudged around Anfield for.
I think we should give Chelsea some credit, though. Mm-hmm. They played against the Big Four this season. They've done the double against all of them, scoring 12 goals and conceding one in the process. I mean, Ancelotti was brought in to make Chelsea exciting, to give Roman Abramovich a team of entertainers. They scored 95 goals in the league this season, and that compares to 72 in Mourinho's first season, 72 in Mourinho's second, and 64 in their
Producer
third.
Producer Ian's wheeling a gong into the...
but we talk about Arsenal being more excited, but they scored 17 more goals than Arsenal, 31 more.
Do you know, if they score five against Wigan...
That'd be 100.
That'd be 100 for the first time since the 1962-63 season, and Spurs. Wow!
Sunderland scored 102 in the Championship a few seasons ago. It's not all it's cut out to be, you know.
All right.
Nothing extraordinary happened.
Right. I was just
Did you notice actually in the lap of honour which Sean rudely, or talk about that, which Sean rudely interrupted to give credit to Chelsea, that how morose many of the Liverpool backroom team children and players' children looked. They looked even underwhelmed by the whole thing.
Can I give Chelsea some credit as well?
Oh, why does everyone want to give Chelsea
credit? Well, wait until you've heard my credit as well, because you won't like it. It's true they've scored a lot of goals, and it's true that everyone outside of Chelsea fans seems to feel it's a slight anti-climax that they've won the league, because we kind of feel we know about this team. I've said this before, it's a personal triumph for John Terry, and that's kind of, nobody really wants to talk about that, but he's never said that he's a particularly nice guy. He's only ever said that he's a tough guy and a leader.
But why would it be a triumph if his teammates are sufficiently good to cover up for his inadequacies?
Well, he's played through injury. He had a very wobbly patch, but he's still the skipper of that
team.
Would
you not say that wobbly patch is ongoing?
Not in the way it was at the time when all the bridge stuff came out, where he did actually look absolutely woeful.
Well, and he looked pretty bad on the weekend.
But the interview he gave last week about, you know, I'm back to my best, it shows his capacity for self-delusion remains as strong as ever.
Well, what do you expect him to say? I'm not back to my best.
He could say I've had a bad season, but...
Yeah, I think it's not just a bad season. I think he's not the player he was. He was never the fastest, but Alan Hansen was saying the other day, goes to ground all the time, and it's true.
Speaking of wobbly patches, Gerrard, Meerkat United FC, saying, I'm really concerned at Gerrard's form from an England perspective. He disappeared against Madrid after 60 minutes. He's been poor so far today, Atletico Madrid that is, and his performances so far this season haven't exactly set the world alight. Is he entering the kind of the shadowy twilight years of his career already or something? Or what's going on?
Well, it's kind of hard to know whether it's just down to shortcomings on his own part or the fact that he isn't surrounded by players that are as good as he's used to playing with. Like, say, last season when Liverpool were good, he excelled. Were Liverpool good because he was excelling, or did he excel because Liverpool were good, if you know what I mean?
There are those who say Gerrard is a...
Had he finished, Barry?
Sorry, yeah, Barry. Okay, pretty much. I wasn't really sure where it was going, to be honest. I was kind of glad Barney stepped in.
I saw myself kind of riding in on a stallion at that point. There are those who say he's an explosive kind of player, and that's what he brings, you know, energy and thrust. And as you get older, that's probably the one thing you lose. And I don't know, I mean, he's obviously very talented in other areas.
Well, I'd say there are two things. First of all, I think he misses Xavi Alonso, who I thought he linked very well with last season. Second thing is, I think Gerrard is the kind of player that needs an arm around. He needs to be loved. He needs to be told that he's great. And I think Rafa Benitez isn't the man that to do that. Particularly this season, where he's been more morose than some of the players' kids yesterday afternoon, as Barry rightly pointed out.
Benitez has been there since 2004, though, hasn't he? And he's done pretty well up until this season.
But that's because he had Xavi Alonso putting an arm around him, perhaps. I don't know. In the meantime, United won, despite the best efforts of Dimitar Berbatov at Sunderland, leaving Sir Alex Ferguson clutching at straws. So, any chance that Wigan can stop Chelsea at Stamford Bridge?
Well,
there's a chance. The bookies make it Chelsea 1-14 on. It's just they have roughly about a 7% chance of not winning the league. I think that's probably about right.
If Wigan draw, that's enough for United, isn't it?
Well, United would have to beat Stoke as well.
Yeah,
and I think United are more likely to not get a result against Stoke than Chelsea are to not get a result against Wigan.
Wigan beat Chelsea 3-1 the last time these two teams met. My research indicates that in April 2008, they had a 1-1 draw with Wigan at Stamford Bridge, which effectively laid rest to their title hopes, Chelsea.
And Wigan, of course, beat Arsenal very recently in decisive fashion.
Well, there you go, Sir Alex.
There's a difference between Wigan at home and Wigan away.
There is.
What's the difference?
Wigan aren't very good away.
Several hundred miles. Yeah. So a big game anyway. But you think, Barry, that they are less likely to drop points against Wigan than Man United are at home to Stoke?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't been particularly impressed with anything I've seen Manchester United recently. Yesterday against Sunderland, they weren't... You know, Sunderland are not very good. While United won comfortably, they still only scored one goal.
They had so many chances. I mean, it was an extraordinary game.
It's a decent victory, isn't it? Teams don't win there very often. Mm. But I think people are blaming Dimitar Berbatov for the entire season, aren't they? Which seems slightly unfair. I mean, wouldn't you blame not buying any more attacking players when you lose Ronaldo and Tevez?
Yeah, I mean, those two contributed over 50 goals between them last season. I think United had a lot of injuries as well, so I think it's a little bit simplistic. But then I suppose when you pay 30 million for someone, you do expect them to be able to knock in from 2 yards instead of loop it over the bar like you're doing one of those Phil Mickelson lob wedge shots.
Mm.
But it was clear last season that Berbatov, it wasn't really working out. I mean, he's actually probably had a better season than last year. It's just that he was relied on a bit more this year. I mean, I remember when he joined, talking about feeling slightly overawed by the players around him, and Wayne's got so much skill, just sharing a training ground with him is an honour. And he did kind of think maybe it was a big step up for him.
Mm.
And I think probably quite likely they'll cut their losses on him, do you think?
Do you think? It'd be quite a difficult job, that, selling Berbatov at the moment, I would have said. Possibly not. Anyway, also coming up, and very, very, very exciting, this Wednesday, that big showdown at Eastlands, because the Racer falls down to two now after City dispatched Aston Villa, and of course Spurs beat Bolton. Interesting. How do you see Wednesday's big game then?
Well, I was looking earlier. Spurs have got a horrible record against the top 10 away from home this season. They've played eight games. They haven't won a single one. They've drawn four and lost four. On the flip side, though, they do brilliantly away at Man City. Mm. The last eight games, they've got 19 points out of possible 24. City have only scored four goals at home in the last six games. So
against Spurs?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I guess the two key things for Spurs, I think, they may be without Gomez, they may be without Ledley King, and I think those two players are, you know, are vitally important for
right.
them.
If you were Harry Redknapp, would you put Palacios back in the side?
Yes.
Even though that's what's been touted as the possible reason for the formational problems that hampered them at Old Trafford the week before.
I think Palacios gives Spurs a little bit of tiger and bite. I think Vieira likes to be languid and he likes to take his time on the ball. I think you need someone in his face, and I think Palacios is perhaps a better person to do that than Huddleston.
What does your gut tell you about this game, Barry Glendin?
My gut tells me that Manchester City will win it, but my gut is not the most reliable organ or part of my body.
Tell us more.
Which is the most reliable organ in your body?
Don't go there, Jimbo.
I'd have to say my heart.
Really?
Aww. Well, no, it's just taken such punishment in my entire adult life, and it continues to beat.
Romantically or in the
emotional sort of punishment?
No, I just mean purely physically. Abuse, alcohol, nicotine, cigarette, gunk.
Barney, Eastlands this Wednesday.
Well, I agree with Barry. I think that Man City will win. They've kind of assembled a team by hurling enough good players into the mix, and they do have a stronger attack than Spurs, and I think they'll just edge it. And I think, actually, a season on from now, that will seem quite logical, and I think Man City are the coming team, and probably Spurs are playing at the peak of
it. See, I don't know why. I actually think Spurs are going to take it, and I think they have far more cohesion and belief to them than City do. But
certainly, it reminds me a bit of the 2003-04, when, remember, Chelsea played Liverpool, and that was a showdown for the last Champions League place. And Chelsea won, Abramovich came in, suddenly, you know, the course of football history was changed. If City do finish fourth, you could see them being able to buy lots of big-name players in the summer because they'll be in the Champions League. And if that's the case, then they could well be, you know, favourites for the league title, you know, for the next, you know, year, two, 3 years.
But I heard some people in the office earlier this morning saying, you know, if City come forth, it'll signify the end of football. And I just find it really hard to care which of them comes forth.
Really?
I would find it really funny if whoever does come forth then proceeds to get knocked out in the first qualifying round by
PSG. But that might happen, but
something.
I think Sean's right. I think if City come forth, we're going to be talking about them a hell of a lot from now, and I think they are the coming power. Mm. But they're certainly on an upswing, whereas I think Spurs are probably right at the ceiling of what they're going to achieve.
Well, there you go. Huge game coming up anyway on Wednesday. Now, that's it for part one. In a second or two, we'll be hearing from Sid Lowe in Spain.
Football Weekly from Guardian.co.uk with James Richardson.
Hello, Sid.
Hello.
Hello, Sid.
Hello.
Hello.
Gong.
Sean tells me you had a very exciting time of it last night with Real Madrid's game against Osasuna.
Yeah, it was reasonably exciting, except that even when you got into I think it was the 89th minute when Real Madrid finally turned it around, somehow you just knew they were going to do it because they've been doing it pretty much all season. They've had to come back from behind against Sevilla at home, against Sporting Gijón at home, Atletico Madrid, away against Almeria, away against Real Zaragoza, and they just keep on doing it. I must admit, when it got to 85 minutes, I thought, maybe they won't do it this time. But then in the 89th, Cristiano Ronaldo pops up with a header. He played very, very well indeed. And Real Madrid are still just 1 point behind Barcelona with three games to go.
The first of those three games is coming up this midweek. And yeah. Barcelona, who got over their post-Inter Blues brilliantly against, who was it, Villarreal?
Yeah, away at Villarreal, they were excellent as well. Really, really good Barcelona. And one or two people will probably think it's not a coincidence because they were really good having left Zlatan Ibrahimovic out and played Bojan instead.
Wow, interesting. Still no room for Thierry Henry then?
No, Thierry Henry was left out again and didn't even come on as a sub. I think it's the end for him. I really.
So would, they'll sell him on in the summer?
Well, I don't know about selling him on. They'll let him go and save themselves his very, very large wages. I think that the likelihood is that he'll go to the United States. I think that's almost certain now.
Right.
And if that's the case, then I suspect that Barcelona won't actually get a transfer fee for him.
Right. Real Madrid have a very, very big game this week, this midweek.
Yeah, they do. When we look at the fixtures in the back end of the season, one of the reasons why Real Madrid fans have been quite confident, one of the reasons why I think that they may well still win the league is that, it, broadly speaking, it's been harder for Barcelona. Basically, because Barcelona had three away trips. Away at Espanyol, which they drew, which was what allowed Real Madrid back into the title race. Away at Villarreal, which I must confess, I thought they wouldn't win, and they won 4-1 and were brilliant. And away at Seville. So you've got Barcelona still to go away to Seville. Real Madrid really only to go away one really tough game anyway, away at Malaga final day. And that's this week against Mallorca, who, bear in mind, have won every game except three at home this season. So that is genuinely tough. And for the first time, we're looking at, I think, a Real Madrid fixtures for the first time in a few weeks anyway, where you think it might be harder for Real Madrid than for Barcelona. I still think Real Madrid will beat Mallorca, but certainly this is the game where, if Madrid are going to slip up at some stage, it's the most likely game that they're going to do it in.
Well, Mallorca, in the meantime, got into the top four, so they're chasing Champions League football.
Yeah, they are. They're fourth at the moment. They've got a two-point lead over Sevilla in fifth. And it looks like Valencia will almost be guaranteed now to get third place. They've got a six-point lead with three games to go over Mallorca, an eight-point lead over Sevilla, and they've got head-to-head record leads against both of them. So a six-point lead is effectively 7 points. Valencia are basically now safe in that third Champions League place, and it's about Mallorca and Sevilla now.
All right. Sid, listen, Baron Matt posts in asking, are Barcelona's presidential elections in the off-season? Since they tend to be accompanied by audacious transfer promises, it'll be interesting to see who the candidates throw up. Any word on that?
Well, at the moment, the candidates aren't making promises. What they are doing is allowing the media to leak names on their behalf and suggest that so-and-so will have player and so-and-so will have that player. I think there's another intriguing factor in all of this, which is that you've got candidates who have their own targets, and obviously Cesc Fabregas is very, very high amongst them. There's a feeling that continuity candidates will want Cesc Fabregas, and so will Sandro Rosset, who's effectively, if you like, Laporta's most hated man, because he was part of the Laporta's board, vice president with Laporta, and then walked out in the club. The other thing that makes it slightly different is that Laporta, as an outgoing president, appears to want to make a signing as well, as a kind of, here's my parting gift to everyone. So you've got all these incoming presidents jockeying for signings, and Laporta as well, who may well make some signings. Now, there's a question mark about whether or not that's entirely fair for an outgoing president who's not going to be the president to buy some players to lumber the people who succeed him with.
Depends who the players are, of course. On the subject, on a related note, Phil 90 says, is Man City the only place Ibrahimovic can go now? Also, will Barca finally sign David Villa? But the Ibrahimovic thing, Sid, is the thought now that they might try and realise a bit of his potential sale value?
Well, there is a suggestion that that may well happen, that Pep Guardiola has grown a little frustrated at Ibrahimovic's failure to fit into the system. But I'm not entirely sure that they're necessarily going to cash in yet, unless they get a very big offer. So I suppose in that sense, Manchester City would be quite welcome. There's been a kind of a current of opinion in Barcelona over the last few days of trying to rehabilitate Ibrahimovic, looking at his figures and saying, for a first season, this is really not too bad. Barcelona, I think, would take a big offer if a big offer came in. My question mark is whether or not a big offer would come in. As for David Villa, I had a very interesting conversation with someone from Valencia last night. Valencia believe they're now in a position to withstand a bid again for a second successive summer for David Villa, that they would indeed sell if the situation was unsustainable, in the sense that if Villa came out and publicly said, right, I want to go, I've had enough, or if the offer was absolutely huge. But Valencia are very, very determined not to be held to ransom, as indeed was the case last summer when they said they would only sell if they got a scandalously scandalous offer. And they believe now that with Champions League qualification and with the refinancing package put together by the current president, which essentially involves the local government bailing them out entirely, they believe they can now withstand the bid for both David Silva and David Villa, and that possibly they could get away with just one sale in the summer, which might be a sale of a slightly lower level than those two, say someone like Juan Mata or Pablo Hernandez.
Crikey, Sid. Listen, one final thing. As you know, Fulham will be taking on Atletico Madrid in the Europa League final. Atletico warmed up this weekend with a 3-1 loss at Sevilla. You've not been the biggest fan of Atleti and their European prospects. They are through to the final, having won, what, two games on the way?
Yeah, two games. One thing I would say about them, which is, I think is significant, and I've literally just come back now from speaking to Kike Sanchez Flores, the Atletico coach, and he made an interesting point. He said, yeah, it's true that we only won two games, But first of all, obviously they didn't lose or else they wouldn't have gone through. But he also believed that in all of those ties, I'm not entirely sure I agree with him, but I think he's got a point. In all of those ties, Atletico Madrid were always, or nearly always, apart from the Liverpool game, in the driving seat, always in a position where they felt they were more or less in control in terms of the away goals and the balance of the result. I don't think Atletico Madrid are a great side. I still think that to some extent you can make the argument that says people here are trying to explain why their European form has been so different from their league form. My argument would be it hasn't really been the form that's different so much as the format. The nature of an away goals competition has allowed them to get further than they would have done if these had been just lots of draws in the league. They'd be about mid-table, which incidentally is where they are. I do, though, think that they have an extraordinary amount of firepower up front. And if Kun Aguero and Forlan and Reyes and Simao are playing well, then probably they're just about favourites. That said, everybody thought that about Juventus.
Sid, Flores looked suspiciously like he was wearing mascara on the sideline the other night. Do you know him to be a wearer of makeup?
Well, Kiki Sánchez Flores, I've been saying this for years when I've been writing about him, that he does have a strange look to his eyes, but it does look like he's wearing mascara. I think it's just the way his eyes are. And as I say, I suspect that it's not makeup, but bear in mind that his auntie or great auntie was a famous flamenco singer, and he is a little bit, shall we say, pretty.
You may have talked about this already. I'm just wondering, reading somewhere that Xavi might miss the World Cup because he's playing with an injury. Is that true? And is that a problem for Spain? Because Fabregas is also injured at the moment.
Well, I think, first of all, yes, it's a problem for Spain because they've got a series of very significant injuries. Obviously, you've got Fernando Torres just coming back from an injury. You've got Xavi running very, very close. Andrés Iniesta is injured at the moment. Cesc Fabregas is out. There's been problems for Marcos Senna pretty much all year. The same is true as Santi Cazorla. Spain have very, very significant injury problems. I think most of them will be okay, but Del Bosque was saying the other day there's a difference between not being quite fit and not being available. He said, we will have all of our players, he thinks anyway, available, but quite a few of them not quite fit. And he was saying, the question mark is, how many not quite fits do you take? How many do you run a risk with? You run a risk surely with one or two, but maybe not with five or six. The other thing I think is to sound a note of caution here, which is that I think this talk of Xavi might miss the World Cup is slightly alarmist. And what it's really based on is actually a eulogy of Xavi, which was put together by Pep Guardiola after the game at the weekend. Guardiola was trying to point out how much Xavi Hernandez was giving for the Barcelona side. And he said, look, he played tonight risking the World Cup for us. This is what he's doing for Barcelona. And I don't think that Guardiola's intention was to say to everyone, bloody hell, he might miss the World Cup. Everybody panic. I think what he was really trying to say is, what a great guy this is. So I suspect that if it's a genuine risk, then actually he won't continue playing. And I think he'll be fine. I'd be more worried about the sheer number of games he's played this year.
Sid, brilliant. Listen, look forward to speaking to you then with your reaction to the midweek games on Thursday.
Fantastic. Switch in.
Thanks, Sid.
Cheers.
People talk about Thierry Henry going to, you know, MLS.
Yeah.
You know, for a nice little retirement nest egg. It's a shame that doesn't sort of really apply to journalists, isn't it? It's a shame we can't just all go off to America and...
when we've outlived our usefulness, and no longer have anything to give.
Still get paid a big fat wage. For
there's no knacker's yard for journalists. That's
no.
Was it called working in PR, maybe?
Interesting. Or you
can Sunday supplement?
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe. I don't know. It's many years away for all of us.
Yeah, obviously, that doesn't apply here.
Doesn't apply.
You've never taken the PR shilling, have you? Have you ever done any corporate gigs?
Of course I have.
Have you ever done any snooker, James? You ever thought about that?
I haven't done snooker yet, no. Yeah, you think that'd be a good match?
I can see you doing an interview with Graham Dott on the sofa.
Yeah. All right, listen, in the Bundesliga, it's all but over. Bayern, with their 22nd German title, this thanks to a 3-1 win over Bochum, while rival Schalke lost 2-0 at home to Werder Bremen. Not actually mathematically confirmed yet, but given that they're 3 points clear of Schalke, and there's only one game left, and they have a 17-goal difference over their rivals, it is all but impossible for them to be caught. Schalke would have to, my math suggests, win 18-0 or something like that. So, well done.
17-0.
Well, 17 would put them level, wouldn't it?
It depends if Bayern would lose.
Bayern would have had to lose at least 1-0. Well,
Bayern could lose 5-0.
Sorry, it's not very often I get to outwit someone in a mathematical forum, so I'm going to... That's why I left.
Don't get
that.
Too excited, Barry. Remember your heart.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, meanwhile in Italy, there's a title race going on there, as you know, and Roma, being defeated by Sampdoria, had let Inter back into the lead. So Roma played first this weekend, and they won at Parma. Good result for them. They needed Inter to drop points. The game where it looked possible that Inter might drop points was at Lazio, where they've thrown the title away before now.
It was never going to happen last night the way Lazio were.
The thing was, you see, Lazio technically weren't safe from relegation, but their big rivals in that battle, Atalanta in the afternoon, drew, leaving them 5 points behind Lazio with a couple of games to go. So that pretty much took the pressure off Lazio. But above all, Lazio's hatred for Roma and their desire to do anything to stop Roma getting the title meant that the Stadio Olimpico was completely supporting Inter. It was extraordinary. Really, really was extraordinary. When they read out the, you know, when the players come out and they read out the players' names, all the Inter players got wild cheers from the Lazio and the Civili. And then the game gets underway and Inter bombing up its chance after chance. The Lazio goalkeeper, Muslera, who I've never been a big fan of, was absolutely outstanding. He was blocking, saves, etc., all that stuff. So the Lazio fans started singing, "Sit down, Muslera, sit down, Muslera," and then rather less engagingly, "If you win, we'll beat you up." Just to clear up any lingering doubts in their own players' mind. Oh, and then then Inter score, and it's a disgrace, said one newspaper this morning. Parody, said another, and Roma, of course, were furious. But, and I think it's fair to say that this does show that Lazio are a small club with a small mentality, because if you're prepared to... I mean, the players, not that they rolled over, but, you know, Brocchi, one of their players, was admitting that they didn't try perhaps as hard as they might because, you know, the relegation pressure was off a bit, and their own fans were suggesting they might get beaten up if they did, and things
but
like
presumably
that.
This is a first in Italian football, where results or even a whole league title being decided by interests elsewhere. That would never happen, would it?
Not wanting to labour the point, I noticed that four different Serie A matches this weekend were
ended
the draw was odds on.
It's funny all that talk about Benitez going to Juventus. Where that happened to them? They used to be really quite good a few seasons ago, didn't they? It's almost as though some dramatic
big thing happened.
Intervention that they've not hit them. No.
Well, just to clear up, when I was talking about the Bayern title before, it was about the Bundesliga, not Juve's recent pass. Just to round up one or two other things, Napoli this weekend have confirmed their place in the Europa League with a win at Chievo, and Siena are now mathematically down. Oh, and Marcello Lippi has done one of his Italy call-ups for a little get-together, a little pre-World Cup get-together. Now, somebody's been posting in asking about whether Iaquinta's going to make the squad. He's in that little thing there. Somebody else was posting asking about Miccoli, who has now scored 8 goals in the last 6, and most of them blinders. And he is not in there, nor is Miccoli likely to ever make a Italy call-up under Marcello Lippi for the very simple reason that he testified in the corruption case against Marcello Lippi's son, Davide Lippi, who ran a football agent's kind of ring and, according to the judges, kind of extortion agency with the son of Luciano Moggi. And Miccoli got up on the stand and said, yes, he was pressured and he had stuff told to him by Moggi, including, I put you in the national team and if you don't do what I say, you'll never play for anyone again. And as a result, he is now very much out in the cold, internationally speaking, which is a great shame. He's a terrific
player. Lippi could be a bigger man and bring him back in.
Yeah.
Italians are good like that.
They
don't hold grudges.
No. Good. So anyway, that's it for part two, I'd suggest. But we've still got so much to talk about, listeners. Stick around then as we relive the excitements at Hillsborough there in that relegation playoff. Hear from Barney about all the drama there between Charlton and Leeds this weekend. And get Louise Taylor on the line. She's fresh from Steve McLaren's triumph with FC 20 in the Eredivisie. Now, all sorts of drama as was expected in the clash between Crystal Palace and Sheffield Wednesday to determine who was going down from the Championship. Darren Percy's goal with just 3 minutes left on the clock and then 5 minutes extra time. It was a very, very stirring finale, but ultimately Wednesday didn't get the win they wanted and down they went. And then it all kind of kicked off a bit, or at least it seemed to. First of all, Crystal Palace fans came onto the pitch, and then Wednesday fans thought, well, we're not having that, so they came out. And then you had Palace players being bundled off by security men mid-interview. But unfortunately, at that point, just when you know it seemed like something really strange was happening, television coverage cut back to men in the studio. They had a great glass window behind them, so you could see that stuff was happening, including, of course, poor old Clint Hill being set upon by numerous Sheffield Wednesday fans just because he got caught out on the pitch when everyone else had gone. And he had to be... You saw this, Barney, or no?
Yeah, I saw the scenes.
And he was laying into the fans, and they were laying into him. And yeah. Apparently the fans then tried to follow him down the tunnel and had to be beaten back with batons.
I mean, it's. I think that kind of thing wasn't particularly... I mean, it was more common than it is now in the days before there were TV cameras everywhere and we stopped people coming on the pitch. There's always been bad feelings surrounding Crystal Palace staying up at the expense of another team, because there are those who think that they should be relegated because they've gone into administration. And sure, they had a 10-point penalty, but if they then pip you very narrowly at the end, you wonder, well, is that fair?
Now, am I right in thinking that all hope is not lost for Sheffield Wednesday? Because if, as some people suggest, Palace are actually going to disappear into oblivion in a matter of weeks, actively go out of business, presumably their place in the Championship would go back to Sheffield Wednesday.
Well, who knows? I mean, there's no precedent, but that's not going to happen. They won't go out of business. I mean, there's always a threat of that, that they'll be wound up. But it doesn't happen. It won't happen to a football club.
Well, there's
always a going concern. Yeah. There's always money to be made out of them somehow. They've always got income. They've got captive consumers. It won't happen like it won't happen with Portsmouth.
All right. Meantime, you on the weekend were at Charlton Leeds stumbled once again in their quest.
The League One promotion race is actually is very exciting. It's going down to the last round of games. There are five teams in with a shot of getting that last place. I went there expecting to see Leeds promoted, and they should have been, because at 0-0, Millwall were losing. They just had to score, and promotion was theirs after a season of sort of agonising momentum loss. And they didn't have a shot on target in the second half until injury time. And Charlton were brilliant. And it was very exciting. And there were 22,000 people there. And you thought, well, you know, this league is very much alive.
Yeah. So Norwich already automatically up. Leeds are currently in the second automatic promotion place. Then you got Millwall, Swindon, Charlton and Huddersfield.
Yeah, well, Huddersfield is a real outshout. They need to win 5-0 and everyone else needs to lose. But Leeds just need to win next weekend and they will go up. They're playing at home. But they look really nervy. And they're frankly just not a very good team. They're a big, strong, powerful team.
But it is astonishing how much they've choked since January. I mean, really, you know, when they beat Manchester United at Old Trafford, we were all raving about them in the pod. It's astonishing just how bad they've been since then. You know, I've backed Norwich at the start of the season. I'd given up on the bet, and you know.
Well, I've heard that from, I think, a reliable source, that Simon Grayson has apparently lost the Leeds dressing room since Christmas, and it's all over.
Was that true with Jermaine Beckford? Yeah.
And that.
Well, Beckford isn't starting at the moment. I mean, he's dropped Beckford. Beckford came on with 10 minutes to go. I have to say, there's no evidence of that on the pitch. They just, lots of effort.
He seemed to know where to go at half time, did he?
Lots of effort. They're just not particularly good. And that's about it, really. Yeah. I was talking to Rob Bagchi, who's a big Leeds fan. He says they're just flatter to deceive. And also, a lot of that at home, the crowd can get on their back quite a lot.
On their back.
Not so much away, but it could be hairy next week if things start going against them.
Wow. Where are they next week?
Well, they're at home against Bristol Rovers. Win and they'll go up.
All right, excellent. Now, on some posts then, plenty of posts from lucky fans who were at Craven Cottage. For the Cottagers come from behind success against Hamburg. What an exciting second half this was. And people posting and saying if Simon Davis's goal had been scored by Xavi or Messi, etc., we'd all be, what, Barry? It was a brilliant goal, though.
Yeah, it was a brilliant goal.
Excellent. Well done to Fulham and Roy Hodgson.
It's just you could write these comments yourself before they even appear on the blog.
But anyway, well done to Roy Hodgson.
You see, this is a sign that you could set your watch that as soon as a club like Fulham achieves a bit of success, or you know, maybe wins the Europa League, their fans will turn into just totally objectionable, smug nuisances.
Right, I don't know. You've been to the stadium because the transformation's well underway.
What should happen? Nobody should ever win anything in case they become obnoxious.
Yeah, that's correct. That could be the next part of our policy.
Right.
50-minute games.
But there's different ways of winning
things,
isn't there? I mean, this is kind of quite a well-earned success.
Oh, it's amazing, isn't it? They were one goal away from relegation. Well, not on the day he came in, but, you know, in his first...
They were 2-0 down away at Man City with 20 minutes to go, and they scored three goals. They won four out of their last five to stave off relegation a couple of seasons ago.
Yeah.
And now they're in the Europa League.
In the final, if they win... Curious aside, this: if they win, Burnley get into Europe,
possibly through the Fair Play League, not definitely.
Well, I thought, is that only possibly?
Yeah,
it's still bizarre though.
It is. It's interesting. I was looking back at the papers from 1998 when Hodgson was sacked from Blackburn, and I think there was still quite a lot of residual suspicion about Hodgson because he was, you know, he'd done most of his trade abroad and he hadn't really played football at high level in the UK. And people, you know, I was reading one report actually from Louise Taylor, who we'll hear from in a bit. They're talking about complaining about twice a day fitness sessions, players are talking about him taking reverse psychology too far. Apparently, after one match at half time, he told his players, "How are we going to bodge it up this week?"
Do you mean suspicion of him because he's earned his spurs abroad?
Yeah, I think there was certainly.
Well, then it still goes on. If you still read now, like, you know, Roy, he obviously had a lot to prove because he didn't do well at Blackburn. I mean, this is nonsense. He had an incredibly successful career elsewhere. He's got nothing to prove.
And he didn't do that badly at Blackburn. He took them to 6 in his first season, and they finished 13th the year before. Yeah. And then Blackburn got rid of a few players, including Con Hendry, and they didn't do too well after that. But
this is the old story. I mean, Jimmy Hogan in the 50s, you know, and the 40s. It's the same old thing. People who go abroad, we don't trust them, even though there's no evidence.
Why are you looking at me?
We're particularly good at coaching ourselves.
Right.
I remember a couple of years ago, we in this very podcast, I can't remember who said it, but
it was Paul Doyle suggesting that he was a strange man living in a shed in Croydon, sending out
press releases going, press look release. Look what Roy Hodgson has done in Italy. Look what he's done in Switzerland. It was really funny.
Yeah, he took Switzerland to the World Cup, for goodness sake.
Won the Danish Superliga.
Right, okay. He almost got Finland to the World Cup.
7 Swedish titles with 2 different clubs.
Right. I tell you what, he's a legend. And a very nice guy as well, although he does possess a hidden side of steel.
Go on, tell us, Jim. Tell us.
Well, just I've never had the misfortune to be on the wrong side of Roy, but I know that, you know, he's not a man to be messed with.
You never felt his iron fist?
Well, he told me so.
What did he say?
No, I don't want to sound
did
like...
Did he just say you don't want to mess with him?
Were you trying to mess with him?
He had a couple of stints as an Inter manager. And I think of all the clubs in Serie A, Inter were probably the most riven with infighting and most overladen with spurious kind of vice presidents and directorial types. Thus, being a manager at Inter was a very, very political role often. And I think that he, at times, was required to use physical force to get his point across. No, I'm just saying, because he seems such a lovable chap. But I think, you know, I'm saying this in an entirely positive way. I think he knows how to, you know, defend what's his. And what he has done at Fulham. I mean, this year as well, I remember the start of the year, everyone was saying, well, it's a bit of a mistake them getting into the Europa League because this is going to, you know, they'll end up being relegated and knocked out. No, they could be top half of the league, and they could be, and they are, you know, they could be, this is the first time ever in Europe they could win the bleeding thing.
One thing about their team, it is quite an old team. All their players are over 30. I mean, you wonder what he's going to do with it now. Mm. They may have to
Where invest. Do you think he's going to be next season?
He's going to be at Fulham.
Do you think?
But there will be a big bandwagon for him to be the next England manager if Capello leaves sooner rather than later. I mean, he'll be irresistible, particularly getting to a European final.
But considering his training methods, which are quite intensive, and it's, you know, just rehearse, practice this move, and just all these really fastidious drills, would making him England manager be a good idea? Because he'd only have a certain very limited amount of time to work with the players. But he's had decent success with other countries. So.
Yeah, I don't think he obviously knows a bit about tactics and team selection and how to motivate
his players. Talk about the fact that he's unbelievably prepared regarding the upcoming opponents, that he's very, very specific about that in a way that most managers aren't.
Well, I'd say certain players, just by knowing who the next opponents are, that would count as meticulous preparation. Did you read there was a great interview with Benoit Essoukhotou, Spurs fullback, in Saturday's Guardian. And he said, you know, the footballers are all mercenaries and we only go where we go for the money. And but one quote which I thought was quite telling was he said the reason he likes Harry Redknapp is because Harry doesn't care if I don't know who our next opponents are.
MDFGH says, are we getting a little ahead of ourselves with Roy Hodgson? He's being touted as a future England manager based on taking a lower level Premiership club to a Europa League final with a couple of unlikely but excellent comebacks. It's also exactly what England did in 2006 with Steve McClaren after his Borough adventure in the UEFA Cup.
Well, not and quite. Look I mean, where Steve McClaren hadn't managed in 5 or 6 different countries.
You're quite right.
And gone to major tournaments.
And when MDFGH posted that, Steve McClaren was probably a bit of a punchline, if you like, to a footballing joke. But no longer. Far from it, because yesterday afternoon, his FC 20 picked up the Eredivisie title for the first time in their history. With a stirring 2-0 win over Nac Breda, wasn't it? Yeah. Extraordinary scenes there at the end. And Louise Taylor was there, and she joins us now on the line. Louise, how was the whole experience for you?
It was fantastic. Any English manager that thinks finishing fourth in the Premier League is the ultimate should perhaps have been there to see. I mean, Steve McLaren, you know, the whole stadium sort of chanting his name and being carried around on the shoulders of his players, and it was amazing. It was, there's only one Steve McLaren. Every Dutch newspaper that you see has his picture on the front of it.
Well, well done, Steve McLaren. As many papers are pointing out, he is the first English manager to win a top division title anywhere, including England, since 1996.
He was rather pleased with himself, and rightly so, because what makes the achievement even greater is that it perhaps, well, as he put it, it's like Blackburn winning the title in 1995, except without Jack Hawker. I mean, 20 are very much a sort of a Middlesbrough equivalent or an Ipswich or a Norwich. Ajax, Martin Jol's team, who finished second, are infinitely wealthier. So it's a tremendous success for him.
And what about the team? I mean, what kind of players does he have? There are no Dutch internationals there.
No, I mean, he's bought quite cleverly. The key man's been a striker called Brian Roos, little known, bought from Ghent. He's Costa Rican. I mean, the game was actually televised live in Costa Rica, and he's the leading scorer. He might move on, as Mike McLaren in the summer. He's clearly been the key. He's sort of Yakubu and Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank rolled into one. He also used his contacts, and he brought Miroslav Sok from Chelsea, and he scored the second goal yesterday. Theo Janssen, a decent midfielder, who he actually suspended for 2 months in the middle of the season when he was caught drink driving. He's quite effective. So they're little known, but they gel together as a team.
The word is he's off to Wolfsburg, and that'll be confirmed during the week, while they head into the Champions League. And they'll be no doubt distraught to see him go. All sorts of comments from Joep Munsterman, the FC20 owner, about how he wants him to stay forever.
He was saying it cool about the future yesterday, and he said he wants to enjoy the moment. Understandably, there'd be a few days partying. I don't think Wolfsburg are the only contender. Sporting Lisbon, Hamburg have been mentioned. I think West Ham, he's already turned down an unofficial approach from them. They might come back into the equation. I wouldn't necessarily think Wolfsburg is nailed on, but we shall see.
Louise, thank you very much for that, and have a safe journey home.
OK, pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks
Louise. Bye.
Barry, are we going over the top with this Steve McLaren 11, do you think? Is it just an easier league to win in?
I think it is an easier league. I mean, it's the standard isn't as high as in other leagues, but it still takes a lot of winning. And FC Twente were put under a huge amount of pressure by Ajax, who won their last 14 consecutive games, to try and reel them in, and they just couldn't. Just for them not to crumble under the pressure is a huge thing, and obviously McLaren would have had a lot to do with that. Mm. And I did notice some disparaging remarks about him underneath the blog that Louise wrote in the wake of that yesterday's game, and I think it's very unfair criticism. He's done an excellent job there. Mm. And yeah, maybe the Dutch league isn't as good as others, but as I said, it takes a lot of winning.
Difference. The standard of the league doesn't in any way deflect from the achievement of winning it, because this team were not expected to win it, and they've beaten teams who were. And he's obviously improved as a manager. He's gone abroad to learn things, and that's really good, and we should applaud him. And he should have done it before he came
to England.
With
suspicion when he comes back home. Private Dick saying, in defence of McLaren, or at least his accent, does no one else here know of people whose accents have changed as they've moved around? Was Jan Molby mercilessly ribbed in Denmark, having a Scouse accent? He asked. Yeah, very good point. Very good point. Well, there you go. Well done, Steve. Well done, Roy Hodgson. And well done, listeners, because we've made it to the end of another Football Weekly. Many thanks to Barry Glendinning for his sparkling participation, and to Barney Roney, thought-provoking as ever, Sean Ingle, fat-backed and full of fun, and to producer Ian.
Did you say he was fat-backed?
Fact. I think I tried to go for fact-backed.
Fact-packed.
Well, you could have fact-packed, and it's not working out.
You could accuse Sean of having many things, but a fat back is not one of them.
He's not got fat. He's very
muscular.
Yeah,
lithe.
Very lithe. Sinewy. Yeah.
Sinewy is a good one.
Sinewy, thank you. You're sinewy.
Sean came into the office this morning wheeling a bike. Now, into the actual office.
Right.
Wheeling a bicycle.
Oh, yeah.
While holding a big pair of boxing gloves in one hand.
Wow.
And it was hard to know which to be more bewildered by.
He's the famous boxing cyclist in King's Cross. Have you not seen him?
Does that not interfere with your braking?
I go boxing tomorrow, so I was just bringing them up to my lockers.
Is that with John Ashdown's missus still?
Yeah, it is. She's the demon.
Yeah.
Sometimes what you do in class is you put your hands above your head.
Yes.
And then let Rachel, who's John's missus, just punch you as hard as she can. She can punch.
Stop, you're getting me hot. Right.
It sounds really painful. I know she's quite diminutive, but still, if you're defenceless,
yeah,
being punched in the stomach.
But it's good for your stomach muscles. You squeeze your stomach muscles tight.
Oh, I see.
And then, you know, you absorb the...
Do you get a chance?
Sean is now hitting himself repeatedly in the stomach.
Do you get a chance to reply in kind?
No, we do sparring, but not with the ladies.
The ladies. Excellent. Well, all right. Well, perhaps you'll be back to tell us about that on another occasion.
If you survive.
Many thanks then to producer Ian as well. And we'll be back on Thursday with yet more exciting developments from the wide world of football. Until then, from all of us here, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.